You ever thought about literacy and literacy from a number of different perspectives today? We're speaking with Scott Walter from Code. Hello.
Hello. Hello. Pleasure to be here.
I'm so excited you're here because this is an organization that I feel people know about, but they may not know the details like we're going to talk about today.
Good.
And Scott, tell me first of all what your role is at Code.
So I'm the executive director. I've been in that position for 11 years. And actually, I worked for the organization some 25 years ago. They first hired me in the late 80s and immediately packed me off to one of their offices in Africa, in Dar es Salaam, Tanzania. So in between, I did a few other things, but came back as executive director.
And what's it like to return as the ED?
It was, for me, it was the dream job. I've always worked in international development in one way or another. I always worked in the education sector and literacy. So to start out at Code and then to go work, I went down to the States to work for something called the International Reading Association. And then I worked for the Government of Canada, for CETA, what now Global Affairs Canada. And so then sort of to come back as executive director allowed me to come back full circle and be in charge of exactly what I wanted to be in charge of.
And as a young boy, did you have a love of books?
I did. I did, for sure. I can remember very clearly having a subscription to the Dr. Seuss titles and getting that every month in the mail. But that was a big part of who I was and my own education career, let me say, and being a reader. And that's as much as anything what we're about. We believe in the power of education and the power and the benefits that people gain when they become readers.
It's really interesting because I certainly have heard about Code over the years. And when I heard you were coming on the show, I was so excited because, you know, once again, I've sort of followed a little bit. I've known a couple of the staff people that have worked for you over the years. And I find it's an organization that doesn't sort of get the attention that it deserves because I think reading really opens up the doors to so much. Do you feel the same way?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, on one hand, we kind of joke that we're a well-kept secret and we no longer want to be a well-kept secret.
Right.
But we are celebrating 60 years this year, so it's a long, productive history. But it's, I think, one of the strongest points of who we are is that we've remained true to our mandate, our objective from the very beginning. We've always had this focus on the quality of education. We've certainly evolved and become more sophisticated in our programming over the years. But it's always been about that same basic notion that if you can build foundational skills in reading, in learning, and take it from there, that the world is open to you.
So let's pretend you and I jumped on an elevator. We're on the bottom floor, and we're heading right up to the 20th floor.
Okay.
In that 20 floors, tell me exactly what you do.
Well, Code, it's a charity, a charitable organization. Again, we've been around for 60 years. Our programming supports the quality of education. We have a particular focus and belief in the effectiveness of teachers. But if you were to really narrow it down to our basic pillars, it's all about having sustained access to high quality, relevant learning and reading materials, and then having the teachers, librarians, educators who have the skills to use those materials effectively in the classroom, in the library, etc. The devil's in the detail in terms of how you actually do that, but if you can bring those basic pillars together of great books, great teachers, you will absolutely make an impact on learning outcomes, which is the whole purpose. Are children learning when they get into school?
Really must be frustrating for teachers, especially in developing countries, where they may not have the resources. They have the will, they've got the little ones sitting there, they're anxious to learn, but they don't have any tools. Is that a big part of what drives you?
It is. It is. I mean, again, you know, the world has made huge strides, huge advances over the last 10, 15 years, especially in getting kids into school. So there's millions more, and we work primarily in Africa, but there's millions more students in African classrooms today than there were 10 or 15 years ago. The question, though, is, are they learning anything?
Right.
because the quality has been affected by this huge increase in the size of classrooms and the number of kids at school. And that then affects teachers and, for example, the teacher-pupil ratio. So there's a huge shortage of teachers. And just as concerning, there's a huge shortage of qualified teachers. Mm. So there's a lot of teachers in the system in various parts of Africa who, as you say, are motivated and raring to go. They're doing exactly what they want to do in terms of being educators, but they don't necessarily have the skills and the qualifications to bring about the change that they want to. And then it's further compounded by the lack of resources. So books or, I mean, you know, just about anything, chalk. Mm-hmm. I first went to Africa years ago as a volunteer, as a teacher, and my entire audiovisual supplies were a piece of chalk.
Wow.
So.
How does that experience when you were frontline, if you will, being a teacher, how has that affected the way you now lead this organization and you lead CODE and in all these different transitions that you spoke about, you know, different, more children in the classroom, which is a good thing, but maybe not as many resources, et cetera. How has that frontline experience helped you lead this organization?
I think the probably the single most important thing is it helps me understand the context within which we work. And we have a whole program of research, in fact, that we call Context Matters. And I think that's the point, that by knowing the context, by knowing the reality of African classrooms, of African teacher colleges, of this public school systems, the pressures they're under, the challenges they have, it helps us to then better understand and therefore better support the programs that we're doing. And that's really, I mean, it's not like we're going in and teaching students. Mm-hmm. It's all about building capacity, whether it be at a teacher's college, whether it be at a local publisher, whether it be with librarians in libraries, but to build the capacity to achieve what they want to achieve in those schools and those libraries and those publishing houses, et cetera.
When's the last time you visited Africa?
It's actually about 6 or 7 months ago now. Mm-hmm. I don't travel as much as I used to, but I do get to Africa a couple of times a year.
And is it heartwarming to see the change that's happening?
It is. It is. And I mean, it's, you know, the situation is such that you don't have to be too long, away too long, that you can kind of start to forget the reality and back here in Ottawa and you're working at your desk in front of the computer and you want things to happen quickly and you want responses. And sometimes it's easy enough to get frustrated, you know, and then you go back and visit the program or the country or whatever it may be. And you realize, oh yeah, it really is difficult. It really is difficult because everything is difficult, you know, in the sense of when you have scenarios, countries, which are just challenged at every turn, at every point. I mean, we have two of our main programs are in West Africa, in a country, Sierra Leone, and right, in Liberia. So it's not that long ago that they came out of a brutal civil war. And following that, they were hit by Ebola, which closed schools for over a year. But during that civil war, almost anyone with education was a mark in the sense that they either had to flee the country or they were often killed. So the intelligentsia, the intellectual power of the country was hugely impacted by those civil wars. So they're still catching up from that in terms of looking at how do you rebuild the education system.
Do you know you're making an impact?
We are. We know that for sure. We know that. We monitor our programs very closely. Again, what we're directly involved with in is professional development for educators, for teachers. So that could be in-service, so teachers already in the system. That could be pre-service, so working with teacher colleges. And then also working to increase the supply and availability of high quality learning and reading materials. But the programs that we do, they're, for example, with teachers, there's a very strong set of standards that reflect the kind of performance that they're after. And then there's a certification system which would work with the national government to determine whether or not they had achieved that level of performance. So when we're going in and saying that we want to work with the government to increase the qualifications of X number of teachers, it's very closely monitored, and we have a very strong sense of what the success rate is. It's not just, you know, I can say that Africa, the developing world, they're littered with good intentions, you know. And often the kind of workshops, professional development, teacher training, there's no shortage of those workshops. But unless they're really closely connected to the performance that they're striving to achieve, it can be just yet another so what? Mm-hmm. You know, why are we doing this? What mm-hmm. benefit is there?
Wow. You're so fascinating. And I could talk to you all day, but I'm just so happy we have you here for the full hour. We're going to come back with Scott Walter on An Hour to Give. Stay with us. Did you know there's a global literacy crisis? And in the studio with me today from CODE is Scott Walter. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Thanks for staying with us.
Yes.
So when we talk about a global literacy crisis, can you give us an idea of what we should be concerned about? And maybe this is something that others haven't heard of before.
I suppose the best way to try to describe it, from two perspectives. One is the sheer importance of education and learning as a foundational building block. So every country in the world wants to join the global marketplace. They want to become more competitive economically, and they're simply not going to do it on the backs of an illiterate population. Education is both a human right, and it's an end unto itself in terms of a right. But it's also absolutely key to the achievement of almost every other development goal. And when I say that, I don't know if listeners are familiar with this, but in 2015, the world came together under the United Nations, and they created and named the Sustainable Development Goals. So these are 17 goals which the world has committed to achieving by 2030. It's things like fresh water. It's things like access to health. It's things like livable cities. It's the environment. It's climate. It's reduction of poverty. But not any one of those can be achieved without education and without a thinking developed population. So the crisis is that it's so important, yet at the same time, we have hundreds of millions of students still that are not going to school. So the numbers given are there's something like 260 million students who will never attend school, have never been in a classroom.
Wow.
In addition to that, there's another 270 million students who are in class but who will not develop the skills and the learning outcomes that they need to productively join the workforce or contribute to the society in the way that was intended with the education investment in the first place.
Mm-hmm. Is it still significantly higher for girls? Because we hear a lot that girls don't get education in certain parts of the world. Is it still skewing higher for girls?
It is. It is. Girls are definitely disadvantaged. Like looking across the world as a whole, girls are definitely disadvantaged for different reasons. Now, having said that, you're seeing great improvements. So, for example, in Africa, in urban settings, we're seeing almost parity with girls and boys being able to enter school. So more the discrepancy is with the urban-rural. But girls are always going to be worse off. So the rural girl will always be worse off than the rural boy, or the rural-urban girl worse off than the urban boy. But the problem for girls, it's still one of equality and one of equity. And it's they could be kept at home to help around the house for domestic chores. It could be, the fact is that even with the removal of school fees, which has happened in most countries, there still is a cost and an expense to going to school. Mm-hmm. And if a family is poverty-stricken, which many are, they'll send the boy to school and not the girl. So it's still very much. And then there's still other realities, early marriage. In Mozambique, for example, we see dropout rates at kindergarten. You're seeing almost universal access. So fantastic. That's mm-hmm. over the last 10 years. But by grade 3 or 4, you're starting to see high dropout rates of girls for early marriage.
Oh, my gosh.
So it's the situation for girls and all other sorts of things layered on top of that, mm-hmm. Gender-based violence, access to toilets and hygiene is a big problem for keeping girls in school. Mm-hmm. So in many different ways.
That just breaks my heart because I think that's something... you know, that we're just, it's just so foreign, obviously, in Canada and in developed countries, but it's heartbreaking to hear that. What countries are you working in specifically in terms of code?
So our focus has long been on Africa. We have worked in the Caribbean, and we certainly have a program here in Canada as well. But in Africa, there's 7 or 8 countries that we tend to focus on, from west to east to southern Africa. Ethiopia, Kenya, Tanzania, Mozambique, and then in West Africa, Ghana, Liberia, and Sierra Leone. So those are the main countries.
And do they each sort of have, you were mentioning earlier about, you know, civil war, et cetera. Yeah. Do they each have their own challenges?
Oh, for sure, for sure. I mean, often a misconception, and I think it's simply out of ignorance, a lot of Canadians don't know that much about Africa, and they sort of see it as one sort of monolithic block. But, you know, one corner of Africa to another is as different as, I don't know, Ireland is to Albania,
right.
You know. So Ethiopia to Namibia or Mozambique to Liberia are extremely different. Language, linguistically, culture, all these things. But at the same time, there are universal challenges. The fact that their economies are struggling, the fact that there is large numbers of displaced persons, the fact that they're still very rural-based economies. These are across Africa in many ways, although you are definitely seeing certain countries now approaching middle-income status.
It's interesting because, you know, when I think about different teachers and you think about what's happening here in Ontario, sometimes we obviously have a struggle right now in terms of strikes and ongoing disputes in terms of educators and the province, etc. The things facing Ontario teachers and Ontario parents are very different than that's being faced, obviously, in other parts of the world. What are some of the parities you see and some of the challenges you see?
Well, let me start off by saying once again that everywhere is unique. There's no one-size-fits-all, but at the same time, there are certain universal truths, right? And if you want a high-performing education system, it's expensive. There's just no two ways about mm-hmm. it. But if you look at Canada, one of my favorite global studies to look at is by the OECD. And it's called PISA, P-I-S-A, and it's the Program for International Student Assessment. And they look at countries all around the world, but they look specifically at 15-year-olds. Because if the school system hasn't prepared a 15-year-old for the rest of their life, it's probably not going to happen in the way that you'd like it. So mm-hmm. What's interesting is that Canada sits at the very top. We're part of an elite group of countries that does extremely well on these international tests, and they're focused on reading, math, and science. But to get that kind of performance in Canada, it's because we spend a lot of money, we invest. So we invest strongly in teachers. The number of students in a classroom sizes are very important because ultimately it's about differentiated teaching. That, you know, if you've got 20 kids in the class, every kid is learning differently. So right. the teacher has to be able to know and work with that. But if you've got 40 kids in that class, the ability to work with individuals is impacted hugely. But also the resources that go into classrooms, and of course today with computers and the digital world. So these, if you look then at their counterparts in Africa, it's the same question. But so these are motivated teachers. But they might have 50, 60, 70, 100 kids in their classroom.
Wow.
So the ability to work individually with those students is almost impossible. The same with computers. I mean, we're interested to try to bring the digital world to Africa in different ways. But the idea of like an organization like ours trying to supply tablets or computers, laptops, you know, to millions of children is just beyond us, and it's beyond the ministries of education that we work with. So it's we find the single most important way and the single best way to impact the effectiveness and quality of a classroom is through the effectiveness of teachers. And Canada has some of the best teachers in the world, so they can relate to that for sure.
Absolutely. I just think it's really interesting to see the differences and how everybody's just trying to educate kids. I mean, that's what it's about, is, yeah. is preparing the next generations to have incredible development as we move forward. We've got lots to talk about. We're going to talk a little bit about particular maybe a trip that you've taken. I'd love to hear about some of your experiences and some of the impact you're having at schools and hear about some of the people that you've worked with. So you stay with me?
Absolutely.
Excellent. Scott Walter from CODE, stay with us on An Hour to Give. I think traveling is one of the most incredible things we can do in our lives, and traveling to go to other parts of the world to actually improve their quality of life and improve their education must be an incredible privilege. We're joined again by Scott Walter from CODE. And Scott, tell me a little bit about the travels that you've had.
Well, I first, I was bitten by the travel bug early, and had friends that basically backpacked all over the world. So I had to do a couple of years of that throughout Europe and Asia and Australia. But I think I quickly realized that just wandering sort of aimlessly wasn't ultimately what I wanted to do. So I, in fact, became a teacher specifically so I could go and work in Africa. And got my teacher's degree at Queen's, and after finishing my master's, and I went to teach high school in Lesotho, which is in southern Africa. And it was a very interesting time because it was the late 1980s, and it was really the height of apartheid. And so this tiny little country of Lesotho, completely surrounded by South Africa, and all that was happening in that region as apartheid was coming to a close.
Wow, it's amazing. I mean, I think back to that time, and it was just such an incredible time in our history.
I think Mandela was released from prison around 89 or so, and you know, within a couple of years, he was the president of the mm-hmm. country. Things really did change quickly. Mm-hmm. But I then was offered a position to head up. At that time, CODE had offices in Africa. We had an office in Dar es Salaam, Tanzania, one in Bamako, Mali, and one in Harare, Zimbabwe. So I went to head up the office in Dar es Salaam, and I was in charge of a swath of countries from Ethiopia, Kenya, Uganda, and Tanzania. So I got to travel a lot in that area. And so it was very, very exciting. It was an incredible opportunity. CODE doesn't have offices in Africa anymore. We strictly work through local partners because at the end of the day, it's very expensive to put an expatriate overseas and keep them there. So we preferred to put the money into our partnerships.
Partnerships are really key for nonprofits. What are some of the partnerships that you would have?
Well, so almost exclusively we work, I mean, at the higher level, the partnership is with the government of the day, with the Ministry of Education. Ultimately, we work in the public school systems, and if we're working there, it's at their invitation. So if you're not working with the Ministry of Education, then you've got no business being in the education system, it would seem to me. But in terms of our programming, we work with, for the most part, a single national education partner in country. It could be in Sierra Leone. It's the Association of Language and Literacy Educators of Sierra Leone. In Mozambique, it's a group called Associação Progresso, which is a women's community development organization. In Liberia, we work with an NGO that was set up by a couple called WeCare, the WeCare Foundation. And it was set up during the depths of the civil war when there was a curfew going on, and they started out as a simple loaning library.
Wow.
To give people something to do when everybody was having to respect the curfew. So it's they're all African organizations. They all have their strengths and weaknesses, and as much as anything, what we're trying to do is build their capacity to deliver on their nation's education goals.
One of the incredible elements you have for CODE are these beautiful books, and you brought some in to show me today. And I think what's really interesting, and the very first thing I noticed, is the books in terms of even authors, and of course the pictures, beautiful illustrations inside. They're all very culturally relevant to the countries in which you're serving. How important was that for you?
It's critical. It's critical. And it actually says a lot about the evolution of CODE as an organization, because when we first started up in 1959, we were a donated book program. Mm-hmm. In fact, it was called at that time the Overseas Book Center. So Canadians across the country would be cleaning up their attics and basements, and books were not something you threw away, so they wanted to donate them. And so this organization was set up to share this wealth of books with the rest of the world. But of course, those books are not published for the language, they're not published for the curriculum, they're not published for the culture. And so they did serve a purpose and were often very valuable in terms of, especially I think, as reference materials in libraries. But if in terms of instructional practices and teaching using materials, you really have to have materials that the student, the learner, can see themselves in, that reflect mm-hmm. who they are, that reflect their environment. Mm-hmm. And obviously, linguistically as well, almost every country in Africa has now adopted policy of mother tongue or home language in early grades, and then transitioning to English or French or Portuguese by grade four. who is going to publish in Swahili? You know, if not for a Swahili publisher,
right.
Who's going to publish in Amharic, if not for an Ethiopian publisher? So you need those materials as part of that supportive environment that allows learning to take place and allows high-quality instruction. But you also need the publishers, the authors, the writers, the editors, the illustrators who can create those materials in the first place.
I noticed some of them are in English. And Scott, can you explain why some of them are in English and how they would be used?
So those materials that you're looking at actually come from Liberia and Sierra Leone. But the language of instruction, the medium of instruction in both Liberia and Sierra Leone, and it's got everything to do with their history, but the language of instruction is English right from kindergarten. So Our approach, our policy has always been to support the public school system and therefore the language of instruction that's used in that public school system.
I'm looking at one particular book as we're chatting, and it's called The Rainy Season. And I love, as I flip through it, as I see girls in school uniforms, and I see a female author, and I love that because I think sometimes even if they're not getting it at home, they see through these resources that children, and particularly girls, have a future.
It's a huge point, and so in addition to that cultural relevance that we're talking about in terms of being able to engage the reader, it's also very important for us that we show the characters in the books that we're not simply replicating old stereotypical notions. So, for example, if you looked at old books, the boys would be out playing soccer and the girls are at home washing the dishes, sort of thing.
Right.
But in these books, we make a very strong point of showing the girls to be doing anything the boys are doing, if not more.
I understand congratulations are in order. Do you know why I'm congratulating you?
Tell me.
Well, I understand that Code has been named one of Canada's top 100 charities by Maclean's Magazine.
Oh, yes, yeah.
That's great news.
It is very important to us because it's, you know, there's a plethora. There's thousands of charitable organizations out there. And I think Canadians are very generous and they want to support, they want the help, but they need some help in determining who's good at what they do, who's effective, who's delivering strong programming. And I can come on the radio like we're doing right now and tell you that we're the best organization in Canada. But it's also very helpful when other third parties, such as the media, say, hey, take a look at them. They're great.
It's a really important point. I think, you know, when we have the opportunity to hear about the work you're doing, it inspires Canadians. And you and I both said it at various times. Canadians are extremely generous, and in particularly, our friends here in Ottawa are very, very generous.
No, very, very true.
And so tell me how you work with donors.
Well, we have a number of different donors. We get a certain amount of our funding from the Government of Canada, from Global Affairs Canada, and as part of their ODA, which is the Official Development Assistance, and how they support the rest of the world. But we also, more important than anything, is the donations that we receive from individuals, and as well from corporations and from Canadian family foundations. So we're, first of all, have to come to their attention. They have to know who we are. And shows like this help in that regard. Hopefully we can drive them to our website where they can find out more about us. But it's then a matter of, well, donor stewardship, because donors want to know. They want to know a couple of things. They want to know that their money is being effectively used, that we're transparent in how we report, and that we do have metrics which show and measure the outcomes. But they also want to feel that they're being appreciated and that they're important to us. So those are two sides of the donor relationship, which are hugely important for us.
Excellent. We've got so much more to chat about. We're going to chat about a Canadian program that Code has underway as well, and get your last thoughts on how maybe people can donate, especially this time of year. People are looking for unique ways to give back. So stay with us. And of course, with my friend Scott Walter on An Hour to Give. We've talked a lot about the work that Code has done and has continues to do overseas. We'd like to talk a little bit about what's happening here in Canada. Once again, I'm joined by Scott Walter from Code. So tell us what's happening here in this big, beautiful country of ours.
Well, not surprisingly, what we do here in Canada is very linked to what our body of expertise is, let me say. And so we're a literacy organization. We believe in the power of education and all the benefits from that. And so for many years, we had looked at the question of, you know, shouldn't we be doing something in our own backyard? And of course, I think most people would know that in terms of where are the problems, where are the challenges, where are the lack of resources in terms of education? And it is with First Nation, Métis, and Inuit learners. So we've started up a program that is based similarly on the benefits and power of developing readers. And again, it's very important that if you're gonna support struggling readers to engage with literature, it's got to speak to them. It has to reflect who they are. They've got to see themselves into those in those materials and in the storylines. So we've got a program that's aimed at youth, young adults, because it's often at that high school, secondary school level where you're seeing the greater dropouts. And often there is a question of language. Home language might be an indigenous language. but the school system is using English or French.
Right.
And often the students are sort of betwixt and between, where they haven't had a chance to master their mother tongue, their home language, but neither have they had a chance to master English or French. So this program is named after a particular donor, Bill Burt, and the Consecon Foundation, but it's CODE's Burt Award for Young Adult Literature. And it's quite a neat program where we work with a number of Indigenous organizations across the country, Assembly of First Nations, the Inuit Tapirik Kanatami, the Métis National Council, and we invite authors to submit publications to a jury through Canadian publishers. And then the top three titles are identified, and we then say to the publisher, we'll purchase 3,000 copies of that title.
Wow.
And then put it into reserve schools or friendship centers or community centers across the country. And those books go into some 900 locations in every province and every territory in the country, as directed by our Indigenous partners. So it just means that there's a stock of access to these really great materials. And what's really fascinating at the same time is there's an increased demand for those materials in other schools as well. For example, the Truth and Reconciliation Committee, which has had such a big impact on how we're looking at going forward, the nation as a whole, that is. And it's made a couple of its very strong recommendations are in regard to greater investment in education and a revitalization of Indigenous languages. So the materials, the books that are going into the schools are very much in terms of supporting and building the resources in the schools for instructional practices and then to help improve learning outcomes. But we've also this year, for the first year, created a separate category specifically for Indigenous languages. So our first ever winner will be announced this year for a novel written in an Indigenous language. So that's very exciting for us.
That's very exciting.
Yeah.
As I listen to you speak, you know, all our time together this morning, I can't help but say that I don't know if there was anything else you were put on the planet to do. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I hear you. It's been my life, that's for sure.
Yeah, I can tell. I can tell there's a lot of joy that comes from you speaking about the work, and you just get right into it. Your eyes sparkle, and it's really nice to see.
Well, and there's nothing like a great book.
I know. I love it, too. I want to ask you, so people are listening. I know you're inspiring them. How would they get involved? Do you have a monthly giving program, or can they make an annual gift to you to try and get involved with CODE?
All of the above.
Yes.
So certainly I think the best way is to, first of all, go to our website, code.ngo. And it's a newly redone, revamped website.
Beautiful.
So I think they'll find it exciting. It tells all about our programs. But as well, it certainly tells them how they can support us. And you mentioned monthly giving. For us, that would be the single best way to support us, because it gives us a predictability that allows us to make longer-term plans. And it's like at $5 a month, that makes a huge difference for us. So go onto our website, go onto code.ngo, sign up for the monthly program. And I should mention right now, as we were able to do last year as well, we have a matched giving campaign. So we have a particularly generous donor who's worked with us for a number of years, Uriel Laverne. I'll say his name because
Lovely.
He's such a great supporter. But he has allowed us to put forward a $20,000 matching grant
Wow.
program. So every dollar up to $20,000 will be matched.
That's amazing. I often think, you know, this is an opportunity for us to also teach our children. And this would be a great organization. Like I think about my daughter who's 11, who's got more books than you probably sink a ship, honestly. And I think about how lucky she is to have all access to all of that. But this would be a great introduction for her into philanthropy. You know, let's say together we come up with $5 a month to do that, or $10 a month. And it's a way of showing her the difference books can make in other people's lives.
Oh, it's such a good point. And I think for a young child, for a youth, to buy in, literally to buy into a program in that way, it heightens their interest and their willingness to go and learn more. And I have no doubt that the more that they find out about us, the more they learn about Africa, about education and about the challenges around the world, the more likely that this is something that they'll care about and want to be involved with.
As a fundraiser myself, I think one of the best sentences I ever heard, I heard Desmond Tutu speak, and he said, "This is a noble profession." And it really changed the way I thought about what I did. And I think about you the same way. I think on top of that, one of the biggest rewards we can get as a fundraiser is to connect with a donor who wants to make a legacy gift. Because I think that's the ultimate. We've aligned with their values. What we're doing is what how they feel, and their DNA is important to them. And they sit down and make that gift to us. Do you accept legacy gifts as well?
Oh, absolutely. And it's, again, hugely important to us. And I can't agree with you more with what it ultimately means. Because for them to make that kind of decision, it likely means they've known us for a while. It likely means that they've taken the time to understand and research who we are and what we do. And it means that this is important to them, and they are convinced that we will use their money effectively towards something that is ultimately very important.
You've been involved with CODE for a very long time, and of course now as their executive director. Let's think about 20 years from now. What's your dream?
I've got a 14-year-old and a 16-year-old. They're both at high school. I suppose my dream is that they'll become and continue to be great readers. You know, it's hard for our students as well, because in this digital age, with YouTube as the search engine of choice, you sometimes wonder, will children continue to show that same interest in reading? But it's so critical. It's so critical to their future, whether it be a website or on a computer or a tablet or a smartphone. Ultimately, you still have to be able to read, to take large amounts of information, make sense of it, and put it back in a winning argument. I mean, that's ultimately what we're having to teach children how to do. So, to answer your question, if my kids gain success in that way, I'll be extremely pleased, and hopefully, maybe I'm. Sitting in my easy chair, you know, 20 years down the road.
Thinking about all the work you did.
Yeah, yeah. And that circle of friends that I've been lucky enough to have around the world.
Well, I think through books, we can both dream, we can, go to foreign places, we can have experiences and experience different things through books that maybe we could never experience ourselves, but it makes us whole people.
Well, they talk about great books in two different ways. One is as mirrors that reflect who we are back to us. But great books, we also need great books that are windows that open up new worlds to us. And that's what's really incredible about literature and quality literature, is that it can do those things. It can reflect back who we are, and it can open up new worlds to us.
Well, that was beautifully said. That's a beautiful way to end our time today together. And of course, Scott Walter, really appreciate you coming in today, sharing everything that CODE is doing, not only here in Canada, but of course in Africa and other countries. And we really appreciate your time today.
Thank you, Sam.
And if you want to learn more about CODE, certainly visit their website. And we really appreciate your time today and joining us on An Hour to Give.